2. The rationale of railroad pricing. The anti-monopoly and later movements that wanted government to do something about the railroads arose partly in response to the outrageous handouts that government had granted to the roads. The healthy demand of the protesters was to stop or roll back the subsidies. The former successfully stopped the land grant process, while the latter focused on a demand for local governments to tax unused land that the railroads had received as a bonus and were holding off the market. Many of the protesters went further, however, and demanded various forms of regulation to hold down railroad rates, especially for freight, which was economically far more significant than passenger service. The public demand for rate regulation, when not based on self-interest, as will be seen below, reflected a profound ignorance of the basic economics of railroad pricing. The idea that rates were in some sense too high, or that railroads were monopolies, ran against the hard fact that railroads were tremendously and even fiercely competitive, and that the consuming public was being served not only by land-based transportation across the continent, but also by continued competitive and substantial lowering of freight rates. Footnote: it is difficult for the modern reader to comprehend that before the advent of the railroads, there was literally no way to move over land apart from unsatisfactory local dirt roads. Hence, before the mid-19th century, transportation had to take place over water, and centres of population and production had to be locally nearby. End footnote. Railroads competed between the same cities and towns. They also competed with each other between regions, and they competed with canals and coastal shipping. Obviously, as in any other commodity pricing, the prices of railway rates were set by the degree of competition in the various areas. Along routes where railroads competed directly with canals or coastal shipping, freight rates were forced lower than where such competition did not exist. There was intra-railroad competition between regions, developing between the several transcontinental railroad routes. There was also fierce competition between the five competing trunk lines, between the eastern cities and the Midwest: the Erie, Baltimore and Ohio, B&O, Pennsylvania, New York Central, and Grand Trunk. It is interesting that in their public arguments, the various railroads argued that rates should be set in accordance with whatever pricing theory benefited the particular railroad. Thus, the Baltimore and Ohio and Pennsylvania railroads, which were the shortest of the five trunk lines, argued that rates should be set according to distance, which of course would allow them to undercut their competitors. The New York Central, which had the lowest costs of operation, easier grades, denser traffic, etc., argued that rates should be determined solely by operating costs. And the Grand Trunk, weak and perpetually teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, claimed that prices should only be high enough to cover operating costs, ignoring dividends and interest. There was also vigorous competition between railroads serving the same cities. By the mid-1880s, indeed, there was scarcely a large town in the United States that wasn't served by two or more railroads. For one example, there were in this period no less than 20 competitive railway routes between St. Louis and Atlanta. Complaints by customers, farmers, merchants, and other shippers, and by the general public about freight rates, generally centered around the railroad practice of multi-form pricing, of charging one shipper different rates from another. In each case, the shippers paying higher rates denounced the action as price discrimination, stemming from some sort of conspiracy indulged in by the railroads. But in each case, there were sound economic reasons for the pricing practice. The complaints may be grouped into several categories. 1. Continuing complaints that railroads were charging lower proportional per mile rates for long haul as compared to short haul traffic. But such pricing was the result not of some demonic conspiracy against the short-haul areas, but of the economics of the situation. In the first place, railroads had high fixed terminal costs, the costs of loading and unloading at the two terminals for each shipment, which were incurred regardless of the length of the trip. These would tend to yield lower rates for longer hauls. Secondly, the Western railroads in particular were built far ahead of traffic, and therefore had to keep freight rates low in order to induce farmers and others to develop the region. This would account for lower through, long-haul interstate rates from west to east. The eastern farmers, hit hard by the competition from the west, were of course more disposed to rail against conspiracy than to consult the economic reasons for the differences in freight rates. They complained about the resulting loss of their natural markets in the eastern cities. Similar bitter complaints about higher rates were indulged in by eastern merchants and agricultural-based manufacturers, who saw themselves outcompeted by products made further west. Thus, millers in Rochester denounced the lower freight rates enjoyed to their New York City makers by the millers in Minneapolis. 2. One would think that the Western farmers, at least, would be delighted by the lower rates on long-haul through traffic from west to east. But true to both human nature and the political value of pressure and complaints, the Western farmers too claimed to be unhappy. They protested the higher local rates they had to pay, as well as the discounts that railroads gave to large as compared to small shippers. The rationale for granting discounts for large shipments should be familiar to the current reader. Larger orders reduce the risk of producing or shipping a desired minimum volume, and larger orders are less costly to process since there is a certain fixed cost for writing out and processing any given order. 3. As indicated above, railroad rates will naturally tend to be lower where competition is fiercer, either with other roads in the same town, other regions, or with other forms of transportation. Thus, New York City, with many competing railroads, paid far lower rates per mile on grain shipped from Chicago than did Pittsburgh, which was only served by one railroad, the Pennsylvania. Worcester, Massachusetts merchants paid more for their western grain than did the merchants from more distant Boston. Naturally, the result was continued grumbling from cities which considered themselves disadvantaged. 4. The most intense and persistent griping over alleged geographical freight rate discrimination has been southern charges that the South has always been forced to pay substantially higher freight rates than other regions, particularly the East. In a notable article, the eminent historian David M. Potter has explained these persistently higher southern rates by demonstrating their economic rationale. Potter uncovered several reasons for the higher freight rates in the South. In the first place, the density of population is greater in the East, the lower density of traffic in the South imposing higher costs. Secondly, the principal shipment from the South had been cotton. Railroads early realized that they had to classify commodities when deciding on freight rates. For heavy, bulky commodities selling at a low cost per unit weight could not afford to pay the high freight rates per ton mile that lighter weight, more specialized consumer commodities could afford. Hence, if they were to move these bulky commodities at all, the railroads had to classify the bulky commodities such as coal, wheat, livestock, ore, or cotton into lower rate categories than, say, groceries or clothing. Hence, to make up for the low rates which the Southern railroads had to charge for cotton, they had to set comparatively high rates on other, higher grade goods, including northern goods that were shipped southward. Thirdly, it was the peculiarity of Southern rail traffic that there were for a long time no trunk roads for long-haul traffic from the south to the eastern markets. Instead, the railroad traffic was local, carrying produce from the interior to the coastal ports, then to ship by the coastal trade. Local traffic meant higher freight rates. Indeed, the stiff water competition in much of the south won the coastal route by riverboats on the large and small rivers, meant unusually lower railroad rates on the competing routes, and correspondingly higher local rates where this competition was absent. Fourthly, even after trunk lines were built, the only through traffic was triangular, shipping foodstuffs from the Midwest to the south and cotton from the south to the east. This meant one-way traffic, a costly process which meant little or no return shipments to reduce overhead costs. Again, the result was higher through rates in the southern trade. 5. Particularly troubling to critics was the practice of railroads in granting rebates off freight rates to their shippers. It was charged that the practice was discriminatory and monopolistic, and was used to grant special privileges to favoured shippers, such as Standard Oil. What the critics failed to realise was that, far from being in some way monopolistic, granting rebates was precisely the major way by which railroads competed with each other and with other forms of transportation. The practice of giving discounts off list price to attract or hold customers is a common one in industry now, and there are few accusations that the custom is either monopolistic or discriminatory. The point is that business firms, understandably, do not like to cut prices. If they are forced by competition to cut prices, they try at first not to change their lists, but instead, hoping such cuts will be temporary, grant off-list discounts to their customers. The price-cutting process begins with one or two customers, either to gain new customers or to keep them from shifting to a competitor. If the discounts cannot be sustained, they will disappear and the list will be maintained. But if the general trend turns out to be toward lower prices, the discounts or rebates will spread, especially as other customers tend to find out and demand similar treatment. In short, lower prices will tend to manifest themselves through the spread of discounts off list. Editor's footnote. Rothbard's reasoning for why firms prefer to engage in secret price discounts rather than publicly stated price cuts is an illuminating explanation for why many prices may appear stickier than what they actually are. The historical price data, which supposedly looks stable over long periods of time, may not be the actual prices which transactions are conducted at. Hidden price increases can also occur through reclassifications of goods in pricing categories or charging for previously free services. Of course, prices are not perfectly flexible, but neither are they as rigid as commonly believed. End footnote. There is another reason for the prevalence of rebates, that businesses are often willing to charge less in return for a definite order. As one railroad man explained in US Senate hearings on the widespread use of rebates, a man may say, "I can give you so much business. If you can depend on that, you may make definite arrangements accordingly." We can see then that pricing in the business world, in contrast to the neatly determined quantities and charts of the economics textbooks, is a continuing process of discovery, of trying to figure out what the best and most profitable prices may be in any given situation. Editor's footnote. Rothbard's emphasis on pricing as a discovery process is a major theme in Austrian economics. The argument is that competition, far from being accurately captured in the staid end-state model of perfect competition, where buyers and sellers have no influence on prices and possess perfect information, is actually better described as a dynamic interactive process where rivalrous buyers and sellers have to appraise the pertinent market data, make speculative forecasts, and continually adjust their behaviour. The market process, or the actions of entrepreneurs engaging in economic calculation to allocate scarce resources, is one of equilibration rather than equilibrium. Markets are efficient and welfare-enhancing, even if they are not in perfect competition or general equilibrium. Rothbard, later in his life, did criticize the discovery procedure paradigm and preferred to characterize entrepreneurs in the market as appraisers and uncertainty bearers instead of discoverers. End footnote. This is particularly true of railroads, which have had to price literally thousands of items over a myriad of different routes and conditions. Perhaps this complexity of the discovery process accounts for the fact that railroad rebates, far from being confined to a few large shippers such as Standard Oil, were widespread during the latter half of the 19th century for petroleum refining as well as in most other industries. Such rebates were one of the major ways in which railroads competed with each other. Thus, the New York Central typically had 6,000 cases of special contracts or rebates outstanding. And in California, rebates were granted on virtually every contract. Reductions off-list could easily go as far as 50%. 6. At once the most important and the most absurd charge was that railroad rates were too high in the decades after the Civil War. There is, first of all, the lack of any rational and non-arbitrary standard to determine how high or how low the price should have been. But apart from that, one of the remarkable phenomena of these decades was the continuing and massive fall in freight rates over the years. It was an era that ushered in a new age of cheap transportation over vast distances. Generally, the railroad rates fell, as did other prices, during recessions, but did not rise nearly as much during succeeding booms. As a result, the trend was rapidly downward. These were glorious decades in America, when the increased supply of goods and services emanating from our own industrial revolution lowered most prices. As in all of the 19th century, except for periods of wartime inflation, the general trend of prices was downward. But even in relation to other falling prices, the fall in railroad freight rates was truly remarkable. The fall in rates took several forms. One was an outright and evident fall in nominal rates. Over the decades, these nominal rates fell by one half to two thirds. Thus, the price for shipping wheat from Chicago to New York fell from 65 cents per £100 in 1866 to 20 cents 31 years later. Dressed beef shipments between the two cities fell from 90 cents per £100 in 1872 to 40 cents by the end of the century. In westbound traffic from New York to Chicago, the most expensive or Class 1 goods fell in price from $2.15 per £100 in the spring of 1865 to 75 cents at the end of 1888. Class 4 goods fell during the same period from 96 cents to 35 cents. The most remarkable rate cuts occurred during the Great Rate Wars of 1876 to 1877, between the Great Trunk Lines, soon after the completion of the Baltimore and Ohio route to Chicago in 1874. Class 1 rates fell in those 2 years from 75 cents to 25 cents per £100, while Class 4 rates fell to 16 cents. Eastbound freight rates from Chicago to New York dropped phenomenally by 85%, from $1 to 15 cents. Passenger rates were cut in half in this brief period. Apart from the outright reductions in rates, real freight rates were also lowered by improving the services supplied by the railroads, such as providing storage or carting services without charge. One particular method of lowering freight rates without nominally doing so was by systematically reclassifying commodities from higher to lower paying categories. Thus, the nominal rates in each class could remain the same, but if goods were transferred from higher to lower rate categories, the real effect was to lower the cost of railroad transportation. For example, before 1887, two-thirds of all the items shipped westward in trunkline roads were bracketed into high Class 1 to Class 3 categories. After that year, reclassification in 1887 left only 53% of the items in these highest three classes. That same year, a huge increase was granted by the trunk lines in the number of types of items that were entitled to lower rates for being shipped in full carload lots. Before that year, only 14% of westbound items on the trunk lines were entitled to discounts in carloads. Afterwards, fully 55% of the items were entitled to the same privilege. Hence, real freight rates fell because more items could now obtain quantity discount privileges. Overall, railroad rates had fallen far below the wildest dreams of the Grangers and the other anti-railroad movements of the 1870s. Albert Fishlow, indeed, estimates that by 1910, real freight rates had fallen by more than 80% from their 1849 level, and real passenger charges 50%. Editor's footnote. The Grangers were a farmer protest movement that advocated restrictive railroad regulation, among other interventions. The economic suffering of farmers in the late 19th century was overblown. In general, the real price of freight for Western farmers was roughly constant throughout this period, and their terms of trade improved. Nor were they crippled by rising real interest payments. In fact, interest rates were competitive. Most farmers did not take out mortgages, and mortgages that were taken out were short-term and anticipated future deflation. Farmer anger was mainly due to their income rising less than other groups, and the increased competitiveness and changing environment they operated in. End footnote. One particularly piquant group of complainers against the railroads were the railroad investors themselves. Often mulcted by unscrupulous promoters and inside managers, as in the case of the major transcontinental roads, induced by eager local, state and federal governments to overexpand and wastefully manage their operations, the railroad owners found, over the decades, a none too munificent rate of return sinking even lower. Thus, around 1870, railroad bond yields averaged about 6%, while stock dividends were approximately 7%. By the end of the century, average bond yields had sunk to 3.3%, and dividends to 3.5%. In addition to this virtually 50% drop, only 30-40% of railroad stock paid any dividend at all during the 1890s. Railroad bankruptcies and reorganizations were extensive during the same decade.